Conceptually, spiritually, historically, and anagrammatically, Brian Eno is the one. Brian Eno has probably had as much to do with the form and function of contemporary music as anybody, and his shadow falls large across all styles of music. He is the puppet master, a marvelous mandarin, able to move easily between the rarefied air of the more arcane elements of 20th century music composition and theory, and the blatantly populist arena of rock stars and commercial recordings. Although briefly attached to the fledgling Roxy Music for their highly regarded early albums, Eno soon struck off on his own and developed his uncanny ability to predict trends in music well before they became apparent to anybody else.
Baby's on fire, better throw her in the water. Look, it's her laughing like a heifer to the slaughter.
Although his albums don't sell particularly well, I'd be very surprised if any of his titles went silver, let alone gold or platinum, he wields enormous influence through his followers and collaborators. He is the godfather of ambient music, coining the phrase as well as setting down a lot of the early ground rules. And he has helped shape the sound and careers of musicians as diverse as Talking Heads, U2, Ultravox, Robert Fripp, and Devo. First thing to really strike the ear of young Eno, growing up in England, was the unearthly sounds of the doo-wop groups that the American sailors used to play. The tight harmonies and unusual arrangements were so foreign to Brian that they inspired a curious mixture of elation and fear in him. He found himself free-falling, his assumptions and expectations disintegrating beneath him, and it was a feeling that he would work the rest of his life to capture and duplicate. He also had a strong affinity for machinery and had built up an impressive collection of faulty tape recorders by the time he was a teenager. He liked that they were faulty and never tried to get them fixed because he liked the random element that they brought to a project. In fact, he has stated that he never services any of his equipment because he likes the idiosyncratic elements that such chaos produces. And that, in a nutshell, is the essence of Brian Eno. He is less a musician than a systems designer. In fact, he proudly and emphatically refutes that he is a musician at all. He's much more interested in process than product, and many of his pieces are just the detritus left over after an interesting system has been put into place. Curiously, in the 1960s in England, art school was a fertile place for bands to be born. John Lennon did time in an art school, key members of the Rolling Stones met at art school, and Brian Eno met some of the musicians that would later become Roxy Music at an art school. While working on some early material, Brian Ferry and Phil Manzanera and other members of the fledgling group invited Eno to help out in the studio. He got such interesting sounds out of an old synthesizer that was lying around that the band hired him on the spot. Soon he was wearing a dress and flamboyant makeup and taking the stage with his arsenal of synthetic sound. But the band started getting too polished and professional, too controlled, and Eno went looking for greener pastures. Over the next few years, he released four solo albums, each one split between rock songs and instrumentals. Although popular with critics and especially other musicians, the albums never caught on with a larger public. The music was too cerebral, too intellectual to really crack the top 40, but the punks and the new wavers were paying close attention. Those albums are interesting from an historical point of view, but are not my favorite Eno efforts. It was after the release of his Before and After Science album, when he abandoned the so-called idiot energy of his rock songs and started focusing more on instrumentals and sound producing processes, that he really came into his own. In addition to his affiliation with the popular music crowd, he also had a deep and abiding interest in more experimental and academic music. Inspired by John Cage's book, Silence, Eno began incorporating chance elements into his work, whether it be the I Ching or his more personal form of arbitrariness, the oblique strategies. In conversations with painter Peter Schmidt, Eno discovered that they had much in common in the way that they worked, particularly when stuck on some problem. Each of them had come up with a number of little tricks or triggers for helping get them unstuck, for helping them think outside the box. Together, they drew up a list of about 100 maxims for getting you out of jams and wrote each one on a card. The idea then was to wait until you were stuck on some creative project. Then you'd pick up the deck and shuffle it while you were thinking about your problem, much like a tarot deck, and draw one card out of the deck. The pronouncements ranged from the prescriptive, repetition is a form of change, to abstract, rain, and you were supposed to try to apply this new direction in your work, no matter how obtuse or irrelevant it seemed. They published a small set of these cards and sold them to others who might be interested. When Peter Schmidt died, Eno took them off the market. I had heard about the oblique strategies for years and despaired that I would ever find a copy. I mentioned this one day to my friend Ramon, and he nodded his head enigmatically and said he'd see what he could do. Ramon was my savior in many ways. After committing myself to going back to my high school campus for a year and filming the proceedings of the school year, I realized that I had doomed myself socially. Too old to, legally, conspire with the students, I was also too young to fit in with most of the faculty. Besides, a good percentage of the faculty was still in place from my days as a student, and I just didn't seem comfortable to establish peer relationships with them. Just about the time I was making this discovery, about 3 hours after arriving on campus, I ran into Ramon. Ramon was one of the accompanists for the dance department, and he joined the staff the year after I graduated. I had met him a couple of times that year, and he always seemed fun and irreverent and a little bit manic, and that's what I desperately needed, so I clung to him. Fortunately, the friendship was mutual, and we spent most of our free hours together. Ramon is probably the only genius I've ever spent time with. Razor sharp, hysterically funny, and titillatingly profane, he was the eternal life of the party, even if there were only two of us celebrating. He used to ask me for three random words, which I eagerly supplied him, say, orange, fire hydrant, and penguin. And he would instantly compose a bawdy Elizabethan ballad using those three words in the most sophisticated and ribald way, with complicated but consistent rhyming schemes and elaborate puns. He once had me laughing so hard while I was driving that I had to pull over before I crashed the car. He also got into my car for an hour's trip in the middle of the winter after having eaten nothing but chickpeas for 3 days, but that's another story. Ramon was also a devoted Buddhist and ran chanting groups and shakabuku'd anybody who'd sit still long enough. Being devoutly atheistic, I resisted his advances, and he respectfully let me live my life in heathen ignorance. After I told him about the oblique strategies, he went home to light a stick of incense and chant for them. The next day, when I got back to my cabin, there was a set of oblique strategies lying on the kitchen table. He borrowed them from a friend and had to return them in the morning, but it would at least give me a chance to look through them and copy down the maxims. I opened the box and shuffled the cards. Pulling one out, I looked at it. Lost in useless territory. Kind of pessimistic, I thought, and I put the card back into the deck and shuffled it again. I pulled out another card and looked at its inscription. Lost in useless territory. I put it back, reshuffled the deck, and pulled out a card. Lost in useless territory. Taking the hint, I put the deck down and went to dinner. One of the defining moments of Brian Eno's career came after a car accident. A friend had come to visit, and Eno asked her to put a record on for him before she left. She put on an album of harp music, bade him farewell, and left him lying in bed, recuperating. Soon, Eno realized that the music was too soft to hear well, and one of the speakers shorted out, making the problem worse. Frustrated and unable to get up, he stewed over his misfortune. Suddenly, however, he had a paradigm shift. The music was too soft to follow, but occasional snatches would drift in from the other room, and as Eno relaxed, he began to enjoy these faint whiffs of music perfuming the air. He became interested in creating music that duplicated that experience, music that was unobtrusively interesting, something you could listen to or ignore. Something that would support attention, but wouldn't demand it. And so ambient music was born. Now, there was already a pretty well-known form of music that was created expressly to be ignored, and that was Muzak, a linguistic contraction of music and Kodak. But Muzak was relentlessly cheerful, meant to soothe the somnolent consumer. Ambient music, by contrast, would have a larger emotional palette. Muzak, Eno complained, had no sense of doubt, and it was that eerie unfamiliarity that he hoped to inspire with his experiments. Putting his ideas of interesting ignorability and random system maintenance into practice, he created an album made entirely of tape loops of different lengths running on different tape recorders. Because the loops were different lengths, they would combine with each other in random ways, each performance being different. Once he set these systems running, he taped the results and then released the sonic artifacts of the system as an album. That album was called Music for Airports and stands as his best solo release. The pieces were originally created, as the title suggests, as installation pieces for airports. Airports are interesting places in that they occupy a strange twilight netherworld, neither here nor there. You only go to the airport to go someplace else, and there's a lot of mixed emotion bottled up in the people who occupy an airport, and Eno tried to tap into some of those feelings. The result is a wistful, peaceful, somewhat sad collection of tone poems that were apparently too evocative for their locations as people complained about them and the commissioning airport ended up removing them. But the pieces stand as unique tone poems, filled with a quiet sense of melancholy. Thank you. I used to be a pretty regular lucid dreamer. Lucid dreaming is the peculiar ability to become conscious in your dream. Originally developed in me as a oblique strategy for dealing with nightmares, lucid dreaming became, for a period, one of my favorite things to do. It is a tricky proposition and a careful balancing act. You have to be ever vigilant while lucid dreaming to not get sucked back into the dream, while also not allowing yourself to become so conscious that you wake up. There are some good strategies for maintaining a lucid dream, such as never letting your eyes rest too long on any one detail, or frequently looking down at your hands. But eventually, I always tip too far one way or the other and find myself either awake in bed or sucked back into the vortex of an unconscious dream. But those brief moments of lucidity are wonderful and addictive. Once, during Christmas break from Hampshire College, I had a couple of lucid dreams that were exponentially more realistic than anything I had experienced before or since. One night, while sleeping in my grandmother's house, I had a very fitful night. I kept experiencing that alarming sensation of physically falling, and I kept getting stuck in dreams, unable to pull myself awake. After a couple of restless hours, I decided to get up and get a glass of water. I sat up, rubbed my eyes, and yawned, and stepped out of bed. I wandered into the hallway and had the strangest sensation that my feet weren't moving. Everything else seemed exactly as it should have been, except that I wasn't walking. I felt more like I was floating. I turned around and looked back into the bedroom, and there I was, lying in bed, asleep. Terrified, I dove back into bed and woke up again. Heart pounding, I lay in bed for several minutes, trying to get up the courage to get out of bed. Finally, I felt ready and gingerly pulled myself up and got out of bed. Nervously, I turned around, but this time, the bed was empty. Relieved, me and my body went to the bathroom for some water. In retrospect, I wish I hadn't been so quick to leap back into my body, but I was too scared that if I didn't go back immediately, I wouldn't be able to get back in at all. The next night, I had a dream that I was walking across the campus at Hampshire. I ran into a friend of mine on the path between the library and the dorm. I told her I was having a dream, and she said that she knew she was having a dream too. We We both marveled at the realistic nature of the dream and our apparent ability to share the same psychic space. We came up with a secret code that we could use to remind ourselves of our shared experience while awake and vowed to hook up again in the conscious world as soon as we could. When I woke, I was elated. I was sure we had contacted each other, and I couldn't wait to see her and check her side of the story. The only problem was that we still had a couple of weeks of Christmas break before we'd see each other again. As the vacation dwindled, so did my conviction that we actually met in a dream. Still, I found her after school started and, without any introduction, uttered our secret code phrase. Of course, she looked at me like I was completely nuts. Her name was Kathy, and she was beautiful but crazy, a dishearteningly common combination. She was a dancer at Hampshire, and we struck up a friendship based partly on that common bond. She even recruited me for a dance piece, which I reluctantly agreed to do because I liked her so much. We got closer. I asked her out. She turned me down. Still, I got the distinct feeling that she liked me, or my desire for her was strong enough to make me think that, so we kept casually hanging out. One night, she invited me over to her room after dinner. When I showed up, there was a note on the door saying she was upstairs in room 326, and I should come up there. I climbed the stairs and found the room. I knocked gently on the door, and a sleepy voice invited me in. The room was dimly lit, with haunting sounds coming out of the stereo. When my eyes adjusted to the light, I could see Kathy lying on her stomach on the bed, getting a back rub from this guy Robert, an acquaintance of mine and the tenant of room 326. I sat down. Minutes went by. The haunting sounds continued, flowing through the darkened room like the wandering wisps of incense smoke drifting lazily out of the ashtray by the bed. I asked what the music was. "Music for airports," Robert muttered, but I could hear a plea for me to leave in his voice. Kathy moaned gently as he worked his way down her back. Slowly, reluctantly, I accepted the fact that Kathy would never love me. Dispirited and dejected, I got up and slithered back down to my room, determined to pick up that heartbroken record as soon as I could. After Music for Airports, Brian Eno released three more albums in the Ambient series. Two as collaborators, one with experimental composer and trumpet player Harold Budd, and the other with trance-inducing, or, if you're me, irritation-inspiring, zither player Laraji, and one final solo ambient collection called On Land, which Eno regards as his best album effort. While this run of records was being produced, Eno continued to collaborate with other musicians, producing Devo's first album, Are We Not Men, producing a couple of albums with Germany's Cluster, and extending his tape loop experiments with guitarist Robert Fripp. He also entered a fruitful collaboration with David Bowie, which resulted in what is sometimes called the Berlin Trilogy, Heroes, Low, and Lodger. By Lodger, their partnership started falling apart, but Heroes and Low have some remarkable pieces on them, including some wonderfully evocative instrumentals that, 20 years later, inspired Philip Glass to write symphonic variations. But Eno's most fruitful collaboration, as far as I'm concerned, was with New York City's influential and intellectual new wave band, Talking Heads, and especially with their perceived, if not actual, leader, David Byrne. That collaboration, especially the 1-2 punch of My Life in the Bush of Ghosts and Talking Heads' paradigm-shifting Remain in Light, the two albums most responsible, I believe, for the flowering of so-called world music, raised his visibility to the highest level of his career. But it was his next long-term collaboration that made him an international star. He and producing partner Daniel Lanois shepherded a passionate Irish quartet through three albums in the 80s and made U2 the biggest band on the planet for several years. As if producing some of the most influential and highest regarded music of the past 25 years weren't enough, Brian Eno is also an accomplished visual artist, working on provocative video pieces and installations, as well as collaborating with artist Russell Mills on a wonderful book of art and essays, More Dark Than Shark, Like Oblique Strategies, long out of print. He is the ultimate cool egghead intellectual, fingers in lots of pots, feeling the pulse of the culture from many different quarters. But, like most people, I suppose, his life seems cooler on the outside than it does on the inside.
I'll find a place somewhere in the corner. I'm gonna waste the rest of my days.
He published a year's worth of diary, A Year with Swollen Appendices, which was interesting and informative, although it's hard to really work up much sympathy reading his complaints about having to go record a new David Bowie album, or hang out with Julian Schnabel, or fly to Japan to oversee an exhibit installation. His life is a glamorous whirlwind, but an exhausting one, and despite his intellectual reputation, it turns out old Brian is a rather earthy guy, his head filled with as many images of bouncing boobies as your average frat guy sucking down beers at Hooters. And, also like many of us, his responsibilities often get in the way of his interests, and he finds himself bogged down in the minutiae of his day-to-day life, no matter how mind-bendingly cool that minutiae may be, grumbling about being unable to do what he really wants.
And I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe.
And what is it that Eno wants? Well, according to his diaries, what this mad musical mandarin really wants to do, what he'd really spend his hours working on if all those pesky albums and concerts and gallery shows and books and perfume lines and software projects didn't get in the way, is sitting at his computer with a copy of Photoshop, loading in pictures of women, and carefully manipulating the photos to make their asses bigger. Eno may be the one, the elusive intellectual innovator, three steps ahead of everyone else.
Oh, down beside that red firelight.
But underneath it all, it turns out that his compatriot's queen have him clearly pegged.
Oh.